Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Anthropology. My name is Dana Dennis, and I'm one of the co-hosts of the channel. Today, I'm very pleased to bring you an interview with Dr. Jessica Falcone about her great new book, Battling the Buddha of Love, a cultural biography of the greatest statue never built, from Cornell University Press. Dr. Falcone and I had the opportunity to catch up at the AAA's, the American Anthropological Association, annual meetings in San Jose, California, just a couple of weeks ago. And so we got to have this conversation in person, which was really fun. I hope you enjoyed the interview, and I hope you get your hands on a copy of this wonderful book. This is Dana Dennis with the New Books Network, and we're coming to you sort of live from the AAA meetings here in San Jose, California. I'm here with Dr. Jess Falcone, and we're going to talk about her wonderful new book that came out from Cornell University Press this year, Battling the Buddha of Love, a cultural biography of the greatest statue never built. It's a wonderful story, and I'm really excited to talk with her. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited about this opportunity.
Me too. Glad we could make this happen. So first, can you just tell me the story? Like, how did you come to write this book?
Yes. I heard about this potentially giant statue project. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how it was posed when I was living in Florida, mm-hmm. when I was an undergrad at New College of Florida. And I remember being really interested. Mm-hmm. So my first thought was one of fascination, mm-hmm. like a 500, the biggest statue in the world. They're mm-hmm. going to build a giant Buddha statue in India, and it's going to be the biggest in the world. And I was really, at that time, just intrigued. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't excited or critical. I was just really interested, and my anthropological spidey senses started tingling, and I was like, why mm-hmm. do they want to build this project, and where, and what kind, which Buddha, right, is a Shakyamuni Buddha, what kind of Buddha will they build, why so big, where are they, where are they thinking that they're going to put this, and so the questions just took on a life of their own, and I ended up also being intrigued by the fact that they, and by they, I mean FPMT, the Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition, and that is the organization that wanted to build this giant statue in India. They started talking about it as an engaged Buddhist project, so that was really interesting to me. They wanted to, pitch it as something that would be helpful to the people in the locality. Mm-hmm. And so I was interested in kind of, well, what does that mean to do this kind of development work and also be a religious organization? FPMT happens to be a transnational Buddhist organization, so it's mostly non-heritage white converts that are building this statue. So how does that, how does globalization figure into this gargantuan statue project that's going to be built in India? And so I really was interested in studying the pre-life of this giant statue. And As you can tell from the title of my book, the statue was never built. So I ended up studying the non-event of this giant statue. But I think it's really important to kind of be attuned to pre-events and plans and drafts and the way that people's hopes and anxieties are present in the moment, right? There's a Korean-American artist who coined that phrase that is popular, kind of the future is now. Mm-hmm. And I think that a project like this, an anthropological project that is looking at a pre-event or a non-event really does give life to that phrase. So that's how I came to the project.
Yeah, I agree. We can definitely learn a lot from projects that fail or plans that never come to pass. And I think your book is like an amazing example of that. So maybe we could just talk a little bit more about why. Well, maybe you could start answering some of those great questions you posed at the beginning of your research. You're wondering why, what does this engaged Buddhism mean? What does it mean in terms of globalization when we have an organization primarily composed, as you said, of non-heritage Buddhists working to raise funds all over the world to build this statue in a very specific location in India, in Kushinagar. So, take us into it. Maybe one thing that I found really useful about the book was your explanation of heritage and non-heritage Buddhists as the terms that you were using. So maybe you could explain that a little bit.
Sure, I could start there. And I do in the book as well. So, and maybe even to back up one step further, the book is really divided into two sections. And the first section is kind of interrogating FPMT and its Maitreya project, right? Its heart project to build this giant statue, and looking at kind of the desires and the hopes and anxieties of the statue makers, the would-be statue makers. And the second half of the book focuses more on the locality where they wanted to build this particular iteration of the statue, which is Kushinagar, which is where the historical Buddha passed away. And, I look at the farmers' grassroots resistance movement that sprung up in opposition to the project, mostly due to a massive land acquisition that was essentially through the process of eminent domain going to take their farmland or their homes, sometimes both. So, 2,000 plus farming families would have been very negatively socioeconomically impacted. So, that is the general framing of this book, looking at these two groups that were in opposition to each other and really never met. Like they really were very separated. FPMT did not have any presence in Kushinagar. The Kushinagari grassroots movement really didn't understand at first even what FPMT was and who they were and why were they trying to ruin their lives. So that's the general structure. And then going back to your excellent question, what do I mean when I say non-heritage? I essentially was grappling with the literature that talks about, so-called Western Buddhism or global Buddhism. And I found some of the terminology to be a little unsatisfying. So there was, some terminology that really relied heavily kind of on race or sometimes class as the only determiners and factors. And I found that it was unworkable for me because some of these groups are so diverse. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are FPMTers of every race and every class. So
we're not just talking about rich white American Buddhists.
There are some rich white American Buddhists in this organization, but there are also working class folks in this organization. I've met people of color in FPMT. Mm-hmm. So to, you know, to use kind of the fashionable terminology, which would say, well, we've got ethnic Buddhism on the one hand and elite Buddhism on the other, that was just not ideal. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that enculturation was really the most important thing. And so I use this, I talk about this heritage spectrum for practitioners. And you have heritage practitioners that grew up in a particular tradition. And then you have non-heritage practitioners that chose the particular tradition and chose to engage with it and learn about it. And there's even some semi-heritage folks in the middle who really have very complicated, interesting stories. But for me, I do think that, you know, putting enculturation front and center, I think it was useful in terms of finding a set of terminologies that worked better for me and for the complexity of what I was seeing in this transnational organization, right? Because if you just say, well, it's a Tibetan Buddhist group, that's not very much information. If you say transnational, that's a little bit better, but that doesn't really tell you that much. I think having a practitioner spectrum, and then I also go on to try to define a heritage spectrum for institutions. I think that for me helped as a framing that would show the complexity of this organization in its global Buddhist context. So I identify FPMT as a relatively non-heritage institution because it's diverged so much from its antecedent Tibetan Buddhisms. That doesn't make it any less authentic. It doesn't make it any less Buddhist. It just serves to highlight some of the changes and innovations that they've made. You know, this group that was, officially founded in the 70s, and, you know, you had heritage Tibetan lamas that were teaching, you know, folks from all over the world, from Switzerland and France and the United States and Singapore and Mexico. They were, you know, teaching meditation practices in English. They were teaching, they developed a new pedagogy. They develop new practices. They have, it's a different world. So if you were to go to Sarah J. Monastery, which is a, you know, more relatively heritage institution, the practices there are different, right? And that's, you know, so without any judgment, I just think it's important to kind of acknowledge that in this world of global Buddhism, we have to do a better job of respecting the complexity, both with it, these newer institutions, and also with the practitioners that are reinventing and innovating and practicing in these relatively newer institutions. So thank you for that question, because I do think it helps to explain what FPMT is, right? Mm-hmm. And as an organization and kind of who FPMTers are.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. So with that background, which is really helpful, can you tell us how this Maitreya?
Maitreya Project.
Maitreya Project how was it conceived, and how did it come to be such an important focus for the organization, particularly during the fieldwork period for you, which was in the first decade of this millennium.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it had its roots before that, and it's still ongoing in some form. So
yeah,
how did this project come to be such an important focus for FPMT?
Yeah. So Lama Yeshe is the kind of main founder, if you will. Lama Zopa Rinpoche was his disciple and is currently the kind of religious head of the organization. Lama Geshe had an idea that it would be really nice to build a Maitreya statue. And Maitreya, of course, is the future Buddha, so the Buddha to come. and he wanted to build this in India. Lama Yeshe was himself a Tibetan refugee, so he couched it as a return gift to India as a way of saying thank you for their hosting and kind of providing a space of refuge for so many exiles from Tibet. So the early versions of the story that I read about and that I heard about, he didn't actually say how big he wanted it to be, or even what form it would take exactly. Just a Maitreya for world peace somewhere, probably Bodh Gaya. And after he died in the early 80s, his main disciple Lama Zopa Rinpoche took up this idea and kind of moved it forward within the organization and started talking about it again. I've never done an interview with Lama Zopa Rinpoche, so I should note that this is all based on my representation of the lamas is based on public record. So what's been said in the media. So moving this project forward as his heart project, something that is a way of honoring his guru. And but the project also, went through many hands, and there was kind of experts, and there were engineers, and there were artists, and there were folks that were worried about the donations and the financing. So there was a lot of people, I think, that were involved in making the project as big as it ended up being. So I think many hands ended up kind of creating a dream of a 500-foot statue. And a 500-foot statue at that point, would have been the biggest statue in the world. And so, really kind of supersized dream for a global Buddhist age. Mm-hmm. And of course, big statues are not uncommon. So you can go to Tibet, and I did. So I visited many Maitreya statues there. But this is, Maitreya project was, far bigger in scope and size than anything that had been done in Tibet before. And it would have been the first statue, within the Tibetan Buddhist milieu that allowed devotees to walk inside of it, right? That there would be chapels inside, that there would be teaching spaces inside, where there would be bathrooms inside, which some of the devotees were really upset about when they thought about that, right?
I didn't even think about
that. Yeah. So that there would, that the structure itself was something that people would be living or, moving through and being living beings inside of, which I think is, which would have been quite a divergence from anything that had come before. So so that's a little bit of background about how it kind of became such an important project. And, all of the years that I spent in FPMT, I should say this for the record, it's in the book, but, I embraced FPMT personally as someone who was interested in Buddhism. So I became a Buddhist student in the 90s. I took refuge in the FPMT organization with Lama Zopa Rinpoche. That's the one time we've ever come face to face, was when I took refuge in Florida in the 90s. In my years as a student, as a volunteer, as somebody who saw myself as part of the Sangha, I heard a lot about this project, and it was very enthusiastic. It was a very central part of FPMT's desire for growth. It was a really shared dream, during my research period, when I was going to different FPMT centers, both in India and also the United States, every place had some sort of altar or some set of signs or some posters or places where you can make a donation to the Maitreya Project. Like it's became a very central part of FPMT's shared vision of its future. Someone articulated it as kind of like the crown jewel, right? The potential crown jewel in the crown of FPMT. And I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see, you know, in the future, you know, because there is still an iteration of this that is in process. It'll be interesting to see whether people feel fulfilled, you know, if this statue is someday built, whether people will feel that that dream has been fulfilled. That gives you a little sense of kind of how this became such a central wish within the organization.
Yeah, thank you. So can you tell me a little bit more about, I'm thinking about the chapter that talks about relics tours as one of the ways in which this vision was kind of being built throughout the global FPMT organization and sort of raising funds and also kind of uniting that vision for the Maitreya Project.
Yeah, that ended up being a really central engagement for me. In the introduction of this book, I talk about the fact that, you know, I'm essentially circumambulating a statue that doesn't exist yet. And so one of the places that I found myself, going on this journey in circles was, to follow the relic tour to many of its stops. And the relic tour was a set of Buddhist relics that was collected by Lama Zopa Rinpoche and set in motion kind of as a traveling exhibit. And it made stops all over the world. At some points, there were multiple versions of it out there. There was like a Europe leg, and there was an America's leg, and you know, it really did travel all over the world. So some of these pieces were said to have been from Shakyamuni Buddha, even Kashyapa Buddha, the previous Buddha. There was many pieces from kind of important teachers. So they were kept in these little glass urns and kind of packed in these like, you know, heavy duty security suitcases. Mm-hmm. And they would travel with a kind of relic tour organizers. They were part of the organization that set things up, that had, these really interesting talks about both the relics, but also the Maitreya Project. This relic tour was a part of the Maitreya Project, right? So it really was, the very center of the relic tour, altar was a big statue of this particular Maitreya Buddha that had been designed to be this 500-foot statue. So it was kind of this kind of traveling ambassador for the Maitreya Project. They had always had a video going, kind of talking about what the project would become, why it was important to support it, all of the karmic benefits that would accrue to people who made donations. It really served as an emissary, both, kind of spreading the good word of this exciting, statue project, but also collecting donations for it. And in some ways, it was one of the most kind of tangible aspects of this, this pre-event that I was trying to study, right? Because the relic tour was out there in the world doing this work. And so I could, talk to organizers, I could talk to people who were visitors, I could talk to volunteers and, go and see this piece of the statue project pre-life that was very definitely in motion.
Yeah. I really like the sort of imagery, I guess, of linking the past Buddhas with the Maitreya, the future Buddha, right? Mm-hmm. And the sort of planned project, right? So a sort of immediately imagined future of the Maitreya Buddha's representation in anticipation of the Maitreya Buddha's future emergence. Yeah, it's a really interesting kind of symmetry. And I was wondering if, are these relic tours like unique to FPMT?
So there are relics that are on display mm-hmm. in other places.
Sure.
So I say this with some trepidation because yeah. I'm actually not sure.
Yeah.
If it's the case that it's the only tour out there, mm-hmm. but certainly it was a very public ritual display, and I don't know of any other kind of organized relic tour out there. I saw relics on parade mm-hmm. when they were being installed in temples, so I saw some different versions of relic ceremonies, mm-hmm. but I've never seen anything like this before.
Yeah.
So with the cautionary note that I'm not sure.
Sure.
I would say it's fairly unique.
Sure, sure. I mean, it reminded me of like relic tours organized, not necessarily relic tours, but sort of the Catholic Church's practice of circulating important relics like during the Middle Ages, but I'm not a specialist on that era of history, so I was just like, maybe I'm just like making things up in my mind. But yeah, no, it was just interesting to me mm-hmm. as I was like, oh, maybe this is one of the sort of new forms or practices mm-hmm. of the global Buddhism mm-hmm. of the kind that FPMT is like one of the sort of leading exemplars.
Yeah, absolutely. I would definitely say that, on that list of things that kind of makes FPMT different than its antecedent institutions, I would definitely say that the relic tours is on that list, something where they took something that was a part of the tradition and they turned it into something a little new, right? They put it on world tour, and developed, a set of rituals and kind of a set of practices that would work, just for like one weekend in any context. So one of the things that I found fascinating about it was, it showed up at yoga studios, it showed up at Chinese temples, it showed up at a Vietnamese community center, it showed up, in different places where it had been invited, like whether it was a Buddha space or not. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that there was something, it wasn't a missionizing mm-hmm. practice, but it was an ambassador, mm-hmm. Kind mm-hmm. of sending out something that they would argue has karmic benefit for anyone who sees it, and also has a benefit for the Maitreya project, since it was doing so much fundraising and public relations work for this giant statue project. So it was really unique, and it's no longer moving. So the relic tour is not out there anymore.
Okay.
They stopped that a handful of years ago, mm-hmm. but it was moving for a long time. I don't know exactly how many years, but I'm going to guess at least 10 years. So I think that's fair.
Yeah.
It was in motion for a long time.
That's cool. So I want to ask about the sort of other components of the Maitreya project as it was envisioned in Kushinagar. So we've talked a little bit about the idea of like engaged Buddhism. And that was an important part or a component of the project, right? Was this belief that like it's going to do good things for the local community in a sort of karmic sense, but also in a more immediate and material kind of sense. So can you tell me a little bit about those aspects of the project as they were envisioned?
Yeah, the plan was they were going to build a kind of a hospital, and they were also going to build a school. Mm-hmm. And so they had these kind of corollary projects that were envisioned as being directly helpful in terms of poverty alleviation work. So And they did couch it as engaged Buddhism. So a lot of the people that I talked to said that it was important to them. A lot of the people within FPMT, I should note, you know, said, you know, it's not just going to be a grand statue, right? It's also going to directly, you know, help the people in that area by providing opportunities for medical care and education that they might not have had otherwise. And I do see those as kind of being linked, at least in the vision of what this project would become. So, you know, I think that I was very surprised then that there seemed to be so little care about the potential beneficiaries of this project in the process of trying to acquire land for the statue park.
Yeah.
So, you know, on the one hand, you know, there was a lot of appropriate discussion of kind of like, how can we benefit the people in the locality? And then on the other hand, in practice, there was a lack of attention and care to the ways that the plans were affecting the people on the ground. And it was shocking to me as a researcher that FPMT had no presence in Kushinagar at the time. Not a single person from the organization had a place in Kushinagar, you know, not even, you know, like, you know, flying in a few times a year to kind of do, you know, group meetings or to try to find ways that the local community could be incorporated into some of the planning efforts. There was just a complete lack of interest in what was happening in Kushinagar itself. And so that, you know, really, I think that was a major stumbling block for the project from the beginning.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, your book, I believe, opens with this really tense scene on a bridge that you're describing, where you're sort of surrounded by angry farmers who are protesting the Maitreya project. And so right from the beginning of the book, there's this sense of like, oh, this doesn't go well, right? This is, this is not a case of like, you know, very happy community relations with this international organization. So maybe you could just take us into the details of that a little bit more. So why was there so much resistance to the Maitreya project in the local community, and how did that kind of ultimately contribute to the downfall of at least this version of the project?
Yeah. So now we're getting into kind of the second half of the book, and I really didn't expect. I should say at the right at the outset, I was incredibly naive when I picked this project. Like, I really thought that the engaged Buddhist angle would mean that, you know, that there was kind of social capital that was wrapped up in loving kindness, right? As you know, as Maitri, as this was supposed to be a statue of loving kindness, right? Maitri and Maitreya as a representative of loving kindness. So I thought, you know, well, you know, development projects can go awry, but a Buddhist development project, I mean, they have a deep ethical responsibility that's not an external responsibility. It's it's an internal one, you know, that should be, you know, that is deeply ingrained in their own beliefs and values. And so I really expected a lot of attentive care to the local community. And so it was a little, it was very disconcerting when I arrived in Kushinagar and started doing interviews and you know, realized very early on that this was an incredibly controversial project in Kushinagar itself. So there, you know, and there were differing opinions. I don't want to make it seem like everyone in Kushinagar was against the statue. But, you know, 750 acres of land was the kind of original, you know, that was the original ask. That eventually was reduced to 661 acres. But that's still an enormous amount of land, given how small these farms are, right? These are, a lot of these are subsistence farmers. Many of them are, you know, they're farming kind of fractions of an acre to support their families. And, you know, this, the state government of Uttar Pradesh had basically, you know, worked out with the Maitreya project that they were going to use the Land Acquisition Act. There was this kind of colonial era relic, and they were going to use it to take the land from, you know, farmers who were relying on it, and that they would give them compensation, but it, but the compensation packages were, you know, widely panned as being insufficient is not the best word, as being criminal, criminally insufficient.
Just paltry amounts of money.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, money in and of itself doesn't fully account for the fact that, like, you know, for many of these people, there's a sort of deep attachment to the land where they've been living for generations.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. A deep attachment and knowledge of the lands, and a deep attachment to their communities, you know, so you can't, I mean, part of the problem is you can't just give a family, you know, 10% of their land value and then say, we'll go off and start over somewhere else without watching, you know, a whole community fall apart. And so not only was not only were the rates of compensation very controversial and very unsatisfying to the local community, the prospect of losing their social networks and their social safety nets, you know, their relationships that have been developed in these villages over many generations, you know, that was extremely, extremely anxiety provoking. Mm-hmm. The people who stood to lose land or their homes or their community were outraged and scared. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, on the other hand, there were some business people kind of in the Kushinagar proper in the town, you know, where all the pilgrims come to, you know, to go to the Mahaparinirvana temple to pay their respects. The business owners were, you know, acknowledged that the land compensation rates were too low, and they said that they felt terribly sorry for the farmers, but they still hoped that the statue would come because it would be a really beneficial kind of economic boon for them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I definitely don't want to paint Kushinagar with an uncomplicated brush. There was a lot of different people that stood to lose and stood to gain, but everyone said that the farmers were getting a raw deal. Mm-hmm. And that was really kind of not a fact that's in dispute. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, the farmers themselves then kind of started this organization, the BBSS, the Bhumi Bachao Sankarsh Samiti, this kind of Save the Land movement, and they began protesting. So they started, you know, protests in the kind of public square. They started organizing fasting strikes. Some of them were rotating fasts, so that there would always be, you know, someone sitting there, kind of not taking water, not taking anything but water. Mm-hmm. They had strikes where they would block the national highway. Actions that they took in front of the district magistrate's office. So they had a series of kind of direct action strategies that I do think were fairly effective. I mean, the kind of the local politics of this is really interesting, and I don't spend a lot of time on it, but mm-hmm. I spend a little bit of time looking at kind of the ways that the farmers' movement engages with some of the different political parties in Uttar Pradesh and their cynicism about the things that these different politicians are saying, especially since, it, you know, their read on it was that every time a politician was out of power, they were very supportive of the farmers' movement. Mm-hmm. And then once they were in power, they kind of just kind of allowed the wheels of this large development project to move forward. So, I felt that it was really important to tell the story of this grassroots resistance movement. And, you know, there were times that, there were times in the fields where the anger and the fear and the resentment and the bitterness of, the farmers, or even of FPMTers who felt like their good intentions were being thwarted. The anger of some of my informants was hard for me as a researcher. Mm-hmm. And there are times that I considered walking away from this project, but I do feel that I had a responsibility. Mm-hmm. To tell the story of this grassroots resistance movement. They entrusted me with their stories, and I felt that as hard as this book was to write, it was important to fulfill that responsibility.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't walk away from the project, although I can certainly understand why you would want to if you were, on the one hand, sort of getting on the bad side of FPMT mm-hmm. as an organization, and many people within the organization feeling like your actions were perhaps even sort of directly contributing to like thwarting this project. Mm-hmm. And then of course on the other side, for you as like a visibly white Western woman doing this research in Kushinagar, you write about, sort of encountering some very probably justified suspicion about your motives and whether you were in fact, working for the FPMT project. Mm-hmm. You're not having really an easy time on either side in terms of your working relationships with your informants. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you persevered through that to bring us this book, which I think does tell a really interesting story. And one of the things that I appreciated about it was that it, in some ways does kind of come off as a story of a victory of direct action, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. And it's actually nice to see a protest movement succeed mm-hmm. sometimes, mm-hmm. Yeah. Even though I realize that meant disappointment for lots of other people. Mm-hmm. But
yeah. I should note, to be completely fair, there were numerous factors mm-hmm. that played into the cancellation of this iteration of the project. And I wouldn't want to say that it was just this like mighty, mm-hmm. Ground, mm-hmm. from the ground, a grassroots movement that, where they organized and they were able to kind of defeat this like massive global, mm-hmm. Religious, corporation. Mm-hmm. That did happen, but it was also the case that FPMT was really wrestling with the funding for mm-hmm. the project. And mm-hmm. It's also the case that there were kind of, there was some political, there was some politics, local politics that also played into some of this. And it was a number of factors. So
We're anthropologists. Yeah, we're always saying it's more complicated. Yeah, it's more complicated.
Yes. I do think that the farmers, were a massive factor amongst, a set of factors that came together to make it impossible for that particular version of the statute to happen. Mm-hmm. So yeah. In that way, it is a story of the way that a global project is adversely affecting a mm-hmm. locality, mm-hmm. and the way that a locality can kind of turn the tables and push back against some of these globalized projects, mm-hmm. That seem kind of painful. At one point, one of my informants called it like the Buddhist Coca-Cola, you know? And so they were like, oh, if it's this giant corporation out there in this transnational ether, like how do we fight against them? Mm-hmm. And so I think that they were just incredibly persistent and they were powerful activists, mm-hmm. and they, I think, really fought to make sure that this version of the future, where they were displaced or lost their farmland or their community was torn apart, that version of the future didn't come to pass. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that's a story worth telling.
Yeah. One of the moments that I liked was when one of your informants in Kushinagar said to you something like, well, what if we just took like 500 acres of land in the United States to build a giant statue of Hanuman? Like, how about that?
Yeah.
And I was just like, yeah, that's a completely valid point, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You know, turning it around, mm-hmm. I think is it's a useful rhetorical strategy.
Yeah. I mean, and in fact, the place that fails, that analogy mm-hmm. fails a little is, so I teach in Kansas, and mm-hmm. so I have students that, some of my students are from farming families, and a lot of Kansas farms are actually quite big.
Yeah, it's a totally different kind of farming.
It's a little bit different when I tell this story in Kansas. There aren't as many, people in a farming village that are like relying mm-hmm. so heavily on kind of fractions of an acre mm-hmm. to survive. So 500. So sometimes my Kansas students are like, 500 acres, like let them have it. Let them sell it. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. It's a very different context.
It's a very, very different context. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But even if 500 acres isn't that much in Kansas, I can imagine that mm-hmm. if it was just like, well, we're just going to take it and you're not going to be compensated.
Right, there's nothing you can do. Oh, sure.
That would still irritate people. But yeah, definitely the impact in Kushinagar was like disproportionate.
Absolutely. Yes. And these are poor families.
Yeah.
Like this is a poor region of a poor state, mm-hmm. even by Indian standards, mm-hmm. right? Which is, mm-hmm. A developing nation, right? So I think, it definitely, deserves to be stated for the record that this would have, very directly and negatively impacted families that could not afford this sort of, having their mm-hmm. worlds turned upside down through displacement, mm-hmm. Especially under the conditions in which they were receiving inadequate compensation.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's very true. 500 acres in agrarian India is not the same as 500 acres in rural Kansas.
Yeah. So this version of the project came to an end, but as you write about toward the end of the book, there's a new version of the project in the works that involves components at two sites, right? One component in Bodh Gaya and one at Kushinagar. So can you tell us, like, what is the current sort of FPMT vision for the Maitreya project?
Yeah, I can. Well, I can. This is my epilogue because I've been out of the field for years now. But based on everything that is kind of in the public domain, published in the media, the 500-foot statue that I was researching, what I call Maitreya Project 2.0. Because the 1.0 was supposed mm-hmm. to be built in Bodh Gaya. This book is about Maitreya Project 2.0. The epilogue mentions that version of the statue was canceled in 2012. It was just canceled. There was a discussion about reorganization. The public message was, the funding didn't go as planned. And a year later, or a little bit over a year later, I read that that their vision of maybe having like a smaller statue in Bodh Gaya was going to be accompanied by also having another smaller statue in Kushinagar. So,
so if you can make one big statue, maybe two small ones?
Maybe.
Or, I mean, small in relative terms.
Relatively smaller. And they're still being a little bit ambiguous about the size of these future iterations. It does look like, you know, it might be a kind of a third of the height of what they had anticipated for Maitreya Project 2.0. But, you know, that's all still very, you know, much in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, I'm hopeful. I'm trying to be cautiously hopeful that there's have been lessons learned here on both sides, and that FPMT will move forward with these more modest projects with more attentiveness to the needs of the local community. So I hope that I'm not still being naive.
Yeah.
I mean, I desperately want there to be a win-win at the end of this.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly not a project that I'm going to undertake. So I would invite any other anthropologist out there to look at, you know, what happens next, right? Or to kind of follow Maitreya Project 3.0, and to kind of see what happens next. But, you know, I think it's important. I also hope that the book plays a role in that.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that, you know, a little bit of accountability will be a motivating factor for, a little soul searching.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not, being critical of all of FPMT, FPMT, does a lot of really good projects in the world. And I don't want to belittle the whole organization. I do think that, you know, the process that unfolded in Maitreya Project 2.0, was very chaotic and unsettled, the lives of thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
That really,
even if not by actually displacing them, but just by like holding the threat of that displacement over their heads for years.
That's right. And I think it's, I get really, I'm uncomfortable with the idea that has been, you know, thing people have said to me, well, nothing happened in Kushinagar. I mean, nothing happened. Like just because there was no forcible land acquisition, there was no violence, there was no, but the threat of that forcible land acquisition, the anxiety about it, the way that it affected people's daily lives, I mean, the opportunity cost for all of these farmers who had to spend all this time protesting, right, that did fasting, that, you know, there was a lot of outcomes that were very negative for the local community.
Mm-hmm.
So something happened in Kushinagar. I think that the Maitreya Project as an organization needs to sit with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that they do.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that they do, because in their public messaging, they have been absolutely unwilling to take any sort of responsibility for any part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only hope that kind of, you know, as an organization, they're sitting around a table, like saying, like, how can we make sure that this next version in Kushinagar is better? How do we make sure that we don't make the same mistakes? Like, how do we make sure that we are, you know, following a more participatory model, or a model that doesn't, you know, unsettle a locality, or kind of make our potential beneficiaries scared and anxious and angry? Like, how can we do better in the future? So I hope for that.
Yeah.
And I do think that there is possibly a happy ending in the future. But, you know, one of the things that I really love thinking about the future. So I have a whole chapter that's kind of dedicated, it's, you know, one of the chapter about futurity in this book, you know, where I can be a little playful with this idea of like, well, it's a future statue of the future Buddha, and the way that you know, the way that that anxiety and hope are so wrapped up in one another, mm-hmm. and kind of this this idea of the future tense, right? These competing ideas of the future and how they're present with us, mm-hmm. in ways that are unsettling. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, you know, we have a responsibility to, as anthropologists, to pay more attention, mm-hmm. to the future and the present, right? And kind of the anxieties and hopes. And I think that if, I'm hopeful that, so I'm thinking about my own anxieties and hopes, yeah, as I, yeah. articulate kind of the possibilities for the future of this project and this statue, and I certainly hope for better futures for all of my informants. So
yeah, I think most anthropologists, or perhaps all anthropologists, would agree with you there. We hope for the best for the people we work with, even when we maybe can't see exactly how that's going to work out. Mm-hmm. I was curious, have you heard from anyone in FPMT since the book came out?
Not yet.
Yeah.
I am nervous.
A little anxious about that. That's fair. Before we started recording, you and I were talking about, you know, how nerve-wracking it can be for the people that we write about to receive our work, mm-hmm. and to,
yeah.
voice their own thoughts and opinions about it.
So I sent several packages of books to, mm-hmm. to informants in Kushinagar. So mm-hmm. my BBSS, mm-hmm. Farmer activist informants. Some of them are going to be able to read this book, mm-hmm. and some of them won't. Right? I mean, it's, mm-hmm. Not everyone is literate, and those that are literate, not all of them speak English. Mm-hmm. But there will be some of them that can kind of engage with the book, mm-hmm. and so. But I don't expect to kind of, I might get a letter or two, mm-hmm. from them, but mm-hmm. I didn't send any copies to FPMT itself or as an organization. I know I have friends in FPMT that will, mm-hmm. get their hands on it. And, mm-hmm. I hope they see that I tried to be fair, mm-hmm. and I tried to represent FPMT as honestly as I could. And I tried to, I think I do say in the book at some point that, in trying to be fair to all of my informants, I may have written a book that's somewhat unsatisfying to all of my informants.
Yeah.
And that's the reality of the situation. So I am bracing myself a little bit for, some like very nasty Amazon review, that it's like,
yeah.
this person is going to Buddhist hell,
Well, I hope that doesn't happen, but I'm glad that you're prepared for the possibility.
Yes, I'm prepared for the possibility.
That could happen. Yeah. So what are you working on these days now that this project, which has, mm-hmm. consumed a lot of your life, yeah. has been finally brought to fruition and published. Mm-hmm. What's next?
Well, there are two projects that I've been working on. Both of them have to do with kind of global Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And so the one that I've already published a little bit from, but I've continued working on, is looking at Buddhism in the virtual world of Second Life. Mm-hmm. So looking at Buddhist practice and kind of holy objects and meditation in this digital world. Very different than this project, but also similar in the sense that it's a lot of non-heritage Buddhist, mm-hmm. practitioners that are practicing in a relatively non-heritage Buddhist space, right? And so in some ways, there are echoes of some of the things that I was studying in FPMT in some of these Buddhist spaces in Second Life. And the other project that I'm working on, I've done 6 months of field work now in Kona in Hawaii, and I'm looking at kind of a transnational Japanese Buddhist community, Japanese American Buddhist community. It is quite different. It's a 100-year-old temple that I'm studying, and so a lot of the the heritage practitioners are third and fourth generation, but there's a lot of non-heritage converts that have joined the community, and so it's this really interesting moment of kind of demographic changes and shifts in practice. It's a really kind of fascinating Buddhist space. So in some ways, it couldn't be more different from this project, this book project that we just talked about. And in other ways, I mean, I'm still just kind of, following the questions in terms of kind of how is contemporary Buddhism manifesting in this changing world, right? Mm-hmm. With more complicated congregations than we've seen in the past.
So
those are the projects I'm working on.
Those sound awesome, and I look forward to seeing the fruits of those projects as you continue to kind of tease out these many iterations of global Buddhism. But for now, I just wanted to bring this interview to an end and thank you again so much for talking with us here on the New Books Network.